They used to be obscure. But today on international news, you will hear a lot about Salafi Muslims. They won about 25% of the seats in the new Egyptian parliament last year. In 2012, they took over northern Mali in the African Sahara, imposed strict Islamic law, and destroyed World Heritage sites in Timbuktu. And the Muslims who rule Saudi Arabia are part of the Salafi tradition. But how you define a so-called Salafi Muslim depends on whom you ask. Today, we'll find out who they are, what they believe, and whether we should be worried about this growing Islamic movement. Here to help us understand is Yasir Qazi, an expert on Salafi Islam, who is an adjunct professor at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He is also the Dean of Academic Affairs for the Al-Maghrib Institute, the largest school for Islamic studies in North America, with 35 locations around the world. And he joins us today from Memphis, Tennessee. Welcome to Interfaith Voices, Yasir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first, what is your own relationship to Salafi Islam?
Well, I guess 20 years ago when I was a teenager, I definitely would have self-identified as a Salafi Muslim. But over the course of the last decade or so, I've kind of sort of grown out of the movement now.
What does that mean, grown out of the movement?
I found the movement is not as intellectually stimulating as I would like it to be. I think that it's not really capable of addressing modern issues. It's very intransigent in the way it views certain ideas. It's also very hostile to any who disagree with its interpretation. So I find myself disagreeing with quite a lot of the methodological issues associated with the Salafi movement.
Do you remember what attracted you to it to begin with?
Yes, of course. It was a number of factors. First and foremost, it was the empowerment of being able to understand your religion straight from the texts of the Quran and the teachings of the Prophet. This is a sense of liberation where you're not dependent upon a group of clerics and you have no idea why they're saying what they're saying. The Salafi tradition always challenged people to think about why particular clerics are saying their particular positions, and it challenged people to find the evidences for every single Islamic opinion. And therefore, what it did was it allowed Muslims to reconnect to their tradition. It also allowed Muslims to separate a lot of what was culture from that which was religion. And so a lot of things were dismissed as being cultural. For example, certain dress codes or treatment of women or other things of this nature could be dismissed as being cultural practices. And people were told to embrace a more authentic or a more pure or a more pristine understanding of the faith.
And so to understand this more deeply, Salafi Islam, as I understand it, is an attempt to go back to the earliest days of Islam. Is that true?
Yes. The term Salafi actually comes from Salaf, which means the first generations. And in the context of Salafi Islam, it means the first three generations of the Islamic tradition. And therefore, we go back to the very first 150 to 200 years of Islam. And that time period is considered to be a type of romantic past, a nostalgic element of purity that is missing in today's world. Salafis look back to that time in order to gain spiritual guidance, in order to obtain theological views, viewing that era as having been protected from later developments, from corruption, from pollution, viewing that era as being pristine and pure. And therefore, Salafis consider themselves as following the Salaf, which is the first three generations of Islam.
And it also then encourages people to read the Quran directly and to make their own interpretations and understandings of it.
Well, that's the whole point. That's one of the reasons why it's so popular, and that is that the Salafis are told to go back to the tradition, to read the book critically, and to engage with the texts of the Prophet traditions, to look up exactly what the Prophet said. Don't just trust a cleric who tells you. Go look it up yourself. Go find the book. Go look up the it's called hadith, and hadith means the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad himself. Go challenge your local clerics, and don't just take their cultural version of Islam. Go discover the authentic, the original version. And that's, again, the appeal of Salafi Islam to many people.
What you're saying about wanting to establish a direct relationship with God and not using intermediaries sounds a lot like what the Protestants at the time of the Reformation wanted in Europe.
Oh, but that's exactly the point. Salafis are the Protestant Reformation of Sunni Islam. There's no question about it that Salafis view themselves as the Protestant Reformation. They're purifying the syncretic practices that crept into the faith over the many centuries in the exact same manner that Martin Luther viewed himself as purifying a cultural, corrupted Christianity, a Christianity from his eyes that had been corrupted by the church, by culture, by popular practices and customs. Salafis want to get rid of all of that baggage and return to the original pristine Islam as practiced by the first three generations of Islam.
What would that look like in the modern world?
Frankly, I think that is a question that no Salafi has answered in a very realistic manner. And this was one of the main reasons that I myself found myself distancing myself from the movement, that this type of cliched rhetoric that we want to go back to the first three generation, what exactly does that mean in a modern world? I don't think that any Salafi really has a concrete clue as to how that will take place.
But what are some examples of things that Salafi Muslims are doing that, for them, they say harken back to those centuries?
Primarily, they are teaching a theology, a doctrine that they feel is pure. And what this means is they are preaching against mysticism, against superstitious issues. They feel that their perception of the Quran and the traditions of the Prophet is the only correct interpretation of the faith. And so by preaching this doctrine to other Muslims, this is, they feel, the primary methodology of reviving the true spirit of the faith.
Now, I want to situate Salafi Islam in the larger Muslim world. And typical Americans will often hear about Sunnis and Shias. What's the relationship of Salafis to either of these kind of large, we think of them as denominations often in Islam?
Salafis are a trend within Sunni Islam. So all Salafis are Sunni, not all Sunnis are Salafi. Salafis are a trend, and what that means is that there are a set of doctrinal issues that all Salafi movements will agree to. Most importantly is that unique relationship that Salafis have directly with God. There's a strong emphasis on directly reaching out to the divine without the medium, without the intermediary of saints or of righteous people. And again, there's this notion of empowerment. And in particular, when it comes to worship, when it comes to prayer, when it comes to invoking, Salafis insist that only God can be petitioned for one's needs. To go to any other saint or to go to any other intermediary is tantamount to associating partners with God. So this is the primary doctrinal issue upon which all Salafi movements agree. Within this trend, there are multiple movements within Salafi Islam that disagree about many issues, and in particular, issues of politics and issues of militancy. You have pacifist Salafis, you have militant Salafis, you have Salafis that wish to get involved with the political system, you have Salafis that think getting involved with the political system corrupts one's soul and one's spirituality. So Salafi Islam is a trend and not one monolithic movement.
Now, the Muslims of Saudi Arabia are often called Wahhabi Muslims. Do they fit into the Salafi tradition somehow?
Yes, they do. The Wahhabi phenomenon is Salafism in a particular geographic setting. In the 17th century, a certain tribe basically took over Saudi Arabia, and that's the tribe of the Saud, the Al-Saud, which is why it's called Saudi Arabia, and they allied themselves with a particular Salafi cleric by the name of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, hence the term Wahhabi. And this, if you like, alliance is in effect to this day, where the Al-Saud or the Saudis are ruling and the Wahhabi clerics or the descendants of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab are in charge of the religion. So Wahhabi Islam is a version of Salafi Islam which has had a political manifestation at a time and place in recent Islamic history.
Now, given this incredibly diverse landscape that you've just painted for us, what does the Western media often misunderstand about Salafi Muslims?
I'd like to just mention two particular points. Number one, the notion that Salafis are monolithic, that they're all the same. Nothing could be further from the truth. Salafi Islam is very much like the term Protestant Christianity. There are certain things that all Protestants would agree to. And then there's quite a lot of diversity within Protestant Christianity. Definitely the evangelicals are not exactly the same as, let's say, the Episcopalians. Yet they are both Protestant in nature. Similarly, Salafis do have a very broad spectrum that distinguishes various trends within Salafi Islam. That's the first point. The second point is the association of violence and terrorism to all Salafi Muslims. The fact of the matter is that most Salafi Muslims are actually apolitical. They don't get involved in politics, much less violence, because they view politics, they view the very notion of running for office or voting for people as somehow corrupting one's spirituality. They're somewhat isolationist when it comes to these issues. So far from being militant, most Salafis have nothing to do even with politics.
But I found it interesting, during the Arab Spring, the Salafis in Egypt told their voters before the Arab Spring that voting was heretical. But then after the Arab Spring happened and there was a parliamentary election, they said voting was a jihad. Therefore, Salafi Muslims should get involved. So views on the particulars of politics can change.
And that's exactly my point, that right before the Arab Spring, most Egyptian Salafis were so apolitical, they actually told their followers not even to participate in public demonstrations. They just said, mind your own business, go to the mosque, purify yourself, you know, give charity to the poor. And yet after the Arab Spring, when they saw the power vacuum and they realized that if they don't get involved with the political process, they cannot blame anyone but themselves if the laws do not reflect their views. When they realize that democracy means that people who are interested to effect a positive change in society have to get involved in propagating the laws of society, all of a sudden most Salafis of Egypt did an amazing about turn. And frankly, there's a positive message to be extracted from that, and that is that Salafis can change. Salafis can adapt to the changing circumstance. And Salafis actually became very politically active in a very positive manner in that, and they actually said that participating in democracy is a religious duty. They said it's a jihad, it's a religious duty to go and vote for the candidates you believe in. And that's a very positive change.
Now, before we go deeper into the questions of theology here, I wanted to talk for a second about your own background. You're an instructor at the Al-Maghrib Institute, which teaches Salafi theology in, I think, something like 21 American cities. One of your students at one time was Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who was the so-called underwear bomber who tried to blow up a plane on Christmas Day in 2009. And a lot of our listeners would want to know, did you teach something in your classes that might have inspired him to do this?
I've been teaching for the Al-Maghrib Institute for over almost a decade now, and I have taught close to 20,000 students across North America and Europe. And I think it's not accurate to portray one loose cannon as somehow being linked to us or to myself. I barely knew Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, and the FBI, of course, did a very thorough background check of Umar Farouk after this incident, and they interviewed all of us, and we willingly cooperated. And they themselves said that Umar Farouk went through a number of phases, and he initially started practicing Islam. He attended one or two of our seminars, and he then went to Yemen, where he associated with the radical cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, who was the American cleric that was killed in a drone attack by our government a year and a half ago. And that was where he was exposed to radical jihad, and that was in Yemen with the cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. The FBI, our own government, cleared us completely. Our classes are public, and we ask everybody to come and attend and see for themselves. We do not teach anything to do with jihad or with militancy. We concentrate on doctrines, we concentrate on the history, we concentrate on the issues of worship and rituals. It's a very standard Islamic seminar.
And I know that some of your students since then have come to you and asked about the legitimacy of waging violent jihad. What do you typically tell them?
I tell them that the term jihad is, of course, a term that is found in the Quran and in the traditions of the Prophet, and we need to understand it the way that it was meant to be understood. There are two types of jihad. There's a spiritual jihad, and that means the cleansing of the soul. That means fighting against one's desires. That means having a pure intention in front of God. And yes, there is a physical element of jihad too, and a legitimate jihad is basically a type of just war theory in Islam, where Muslims are told if their lands are attacked, if their freedom is taken away, then yes, they will fight back. And we consider the terrorist attacks that certain Muslim groups do, killing innocent civilians, bombing places of worship, flying planes into buildings, we consider this to be nothing but terrorism. This is not a manifestation of the religious doctrine of jihad.
Yes, and what you're saying, many of the Muslim guests I have had on this show have said, which is that the word jihad means a struggle, is how they've often described it to me. One imam once told me he has a jihad getting out of bed every morning.
I can sympathize with that. So jihad means struggle. And frankly, it's not supposed to have a negative connotation within our tradition. And, you know, we should not shy away from using the term. We need to cleanse this militant interpretation. And we need to bring back the positive interpretation. Jihad means a struggle for truth and justice. Jihad means you stand up for what you believe in. And yes, there is a physical element, but every single society, every single religion teaches its people to fight for the truth, to fight for that which is right. And that is the physical side of jihad. Nobody says that killing innocent people or bombing civilians is a manifestation of that type of jihad.
You talked about the Salafist approach to Islam and the return to the early practices of Islam. What is so attractive about that 7th or 8th century Islam?
The fact of the matter is that Salafis view that era as having been uncorrupted from foreign influence. It was an era, from their perspective, where Muslims practiced their faith in a pure manner, where morality reigned supreme, where theology was understood, where society flourished. And therefore, Salafi Muslims look back to that era for their theological and moral guidance. We need to understand, no Salafi Muslim says that we need to give up technology, that we should use camels or donkeys, that we're not allowed to use a cell phone. When Salafis say they're going to go back to the first century or two centuries of Islam, what they mean is they will try to interpret the theology, they will try to interpret morality the way that that generation did, not they will try to live the way that that generation did.
It sounds similar to contemporary Christians looking back at the very first centuries of Christianity for theological inspiration.
Precisely. And it's also similar to what certain ultra-Orthodox Jewish movements do with their predecessors as well.
Salafis, as you've pointed out, are not a monolithic group. Can you talk about some of the major strains within Salafism?
Perhaps the biggest strain within Salafi movements is how to deal with those outside of the movement. You have many who say that what needs to be done is to preach, is to educate, is to get involved intellectually, is to debate and dialogue. And then you have those who say that, well, if you have the power, well, then you have to enforce your interpretation of Islam on others. And this is what we see what's happening in the Arab Spring, where a number of Salafist groups are actually implementing their understanding of Islamic law, whereas others are merely trying to persuade other Muslims to basically adopt Salafi practices via education, via teaching and preaching. Another fault line, and again, this is similar to the previous point, is the issue of militant jihad. There is a strain, a very minority strain, but it is nonetheless a strain that does preach a doctrine of militant jihad. And that is something that mainstream Salafi clerics have criticized, but nonetheless, there is this minority interpretation. A third fault line is the issue of getting involved in politics. And the Egyptian Salafis are the classic example of a positive change that takes place, that pre-Arab Spring, the Egyptian Salafis were so apolitical that they even asked their followers not to participate in the Arab Spring for fear of it polluting or corrupting them. Whereas post-Arab Spring, they were at the forefront organizing parties, getting involved with the elections. And so this is another fault line that we see in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, in many of the Muslim lands, about the level of participation that Salafis should get engaged in their respective systems.
But one of the things that people who are not Muslim often hear about are some of the things that were reported to have taken place in Mali when Salafis took over northern Mali. For example, they enacted strict Islamic law, reportedly amputated the hands of thieves or stoned women for adultery, and even destroyed some Muslim shrines at World Heritage sites in Timbuktu. Granted, of course, that Christians and Jews have their own violent histories on some of these things. But what drives someone to do such things in the name of God?
Well, realize that these practices that you mentioned are not unique to Salafi Islam. I think the best example is certain areas of Iran and the Taliban of Afghanistan. Both of these movements have absolutely nothing to do with Salafi Islam, and yet they too would practice some of these laws. And therefore, this is an issue that Muslims need to discuss about Islamic law in general. It's not just, you know, Salafi Islam in terms of amputation and in terms of other strict Islamic practices. As for destroying these heritage sites or these mausoleums, we do need to understand that every society, every group, it takes certain symbols as sacred. And for Salafi Muslims, as we pointed out, worshipping anything besides God is sacrilegious. And therefore, there is this notion amongst some Salafi movements that if they have political authority, they cannot allow fellow Muslims, ironically, they would allow non-Muslims because Islamic law allows non-Muslims the right of worship. But these Salafis would say other Muslims are not allowed to worship other than God, and these shrines are visited, invoked, prostrated to, and from the perspective of these Salafi groups, this is something that is antithetical to the teachings of Islam. Let me give you an example that perhaps we might be able to relate to, and that is we as well as a society have symbols that we take as sacred. After all, when we entered the streets of Baghdad and we toppled the statue of Saddam Hussein, many of us would look to that as something positive, that this is the end of an era. And that's because we're looking at the world through our lens of nation state. We need to understand that for these Salafi groups, the toppling of these mausoleums is far more important than the toppling of the statue of Saddam Hussein. Not only because there's a theological element, and that is the worship of God, but also, and this is a key point, many of these movements that did venerate such mausoleums were very cozy with the previous regimes. And so with the Salafis in charge, they are sending a message that we will no longer tolerate those movements that cozied up to those previous regimes. So there is a political element as well as a theological element when it comes to toppling these sacred sites.
You know, this reminds me at the theological level of the Reformation in Western Europe, where very often when Protestants took over what were formerly Catholic areas, they would destroy statues of saints because they considered that also a form of idolatry.
Precisely the point. And that from their perspective, worshiping a grave is tantamount to idolatry.
In Saudi Arabia, where the dominant strain of Islam is Salafist, women can't drive, they can't even leave home without a male companion. And of course, to most women today, including most Muslim women that I've interviewed, this sounds positively medieval and oppressive. So what do Salafis believe about the role of women in society? Or is there a variety of beliefs?
Once again, there's a variety of beliefs, but I'd like to point out this is not unique to Salafi Islam. Rather, one can say that all conservative trends within all of the Abrahamic religions have very strict gender roles, have very strict ideas of what a man or a woman should do. And if we look at the customs or practices of, let's say, the Amish or, let's say, Orthodox Jews or, let's say, other versions of conservative Islam, one finds somewhat of a similar understanding of the role of men and women. And so, once again, this is not a unique problem to Salafism as much as it is to a conservative interpretation of the Abrahamic scriptures.
Well, is there some leeway, though, in the way Salafi Muslims might view the role of women? Are there variations?
Yes, there are, But frankly, from our perspective, that spectrum would not be as large as we'd like it to be. So for example, many, many Salafis around the world have no problems with women having jobs or driving cars or et cetera, et cetera. And yet at the same time, most Salafis, in fact, dare I say, most conservative Muslims would not allow a woman to lead, let's say, a mixed congregation prayer.
In Egypt today, the Salafis in the Egyptian parliament are considered strong Islamists who want to enact Sharia law. But there are many Egyptians who are secularists or who are Coptic Christians. So what's the Salafist view of religious freedom? Could Salafists, for example, accept a setup like that in the United States where religion and state are, at least at the theoretical level, separate?
I think that the question itself is coming very much from within our own paradigm. I think most Muslims will want to see some element of morality institutionalized in their laws. However, the extent of that institutionalization will vary from movement to movement. No doubt, by and large, the Salafis will be more on the conservative side, but as of yet, they are still themselves debating. They are still themselves coming to terms with what it means to be in charge in a democracy. What does it mean when you have Coptics, when you have non-Muslims, when you have secular people, and you're supposed to represent them? And so frankly, there is no one Salafi response to what is going on in Egypt. Rather, you have multiple Salafi responses. We've had some Salafis who said that we can only have a Muslim as a president. And we've had some who've said that we are going to argue for equal rights for Coptics and for Muslims. And so there is a spectrum of opinion within Egyptian Salafi Islam.
Another area where we've heard some controversy, and I would assume this is very conservative, Salafis, don't want music in society. That was true, as I understand it, in northern Mali not long ago. Can you give us any understanding of why anyone would want to ban something as beautiful as music, something that indeed many faith traditions use in their rituals?
Well, once again, I point out that it is true many faith traditions use this in their rituals. At the same time, many faith traditions do view music as being something that is inherently unholy. There were some Puritans in New England that very strongly discouraged the use of musical instruments. Similarly, the use of musical instruments is something that is frowned upon in many understandings of Islam, not just Salafism. And so once again, we have an issue of conservative Islam and not just Salafism. They view music as somehow being inciting towards sexuality, towards feelings that are not wholly positive. And so because of this, they consider music to be something that is inherently unholy.
Might there be any Salafi Muslims in the United States who would want to wage a violent jihad of any kind?
Might there be any fundamentalist Christians in the United States who want to wage a violent war against the Republic? I'm sure there are, but I don't know of any. And if I did, then I can assure you that I, along with all of my fellow American Muslims, would do everything in our power to stop anything illegal in our own country.
So should people in the United States be afraid of Salafi Muslims, do you think?
Not any more that they should be afraid of any fundamentalist organization or movement. As long as Salafis are going to obey the law, that's fine and legal, and we should give them the same protections under the First Amendment that we give every other religious group. The minute that any movement, including Salafis, want to go against our laws, want to disobey our laws, want to contravene our laws, that is when we need to get involved as a society.
Salafi Islam is growing around the world. Why do you think that is?
One of the main reasons that Salafi Islam is popular is that it empowers the people. It challenges them to think critically. It makes them feel a connection with the tradition. It tells them to research, to buy the classical books, to read up the ancient texts, and don't just follow what your local cleric teaches you. Also, believe it or not, if you think about it, it actually makes a lot of sense. Salafi Islam is very rational in that It opposes the mysticism of the mystics. It opposes the superstition of those branches of Islam that might believe in supernatural powers of the dead or of invoking the saints. It actually promotes a direct relationship with God. And so it does appeal to a rational mind. It does appeal to a mind that is inquisitive and curious. It allows Muslims to look back at a period that is deemed to be a type of utopia, a type of romantic nostalgia. So for all of these reasons, Salafism is on the rise.
Yasir Qazi is an expert on Salafi Islam, who is an adjunct professor of religion at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee. He is also the Dean of Academic Studies for the Al-Maghrib Institute, the largest school for Islamic studies in North America. Thank you so much for joining us, Yasir.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.